Welcome listeners for another episode of the Indian Cycling Podcast. As we had promised last time, we are back with the coverage of the week one. And to do that, I have Sandeep Krishna with me. Welcome, Sandeep.
Hi, Gokul. Thanks for having me again.
So, well, it was a fantastic first week, right, Sandeep?
Yes, this was a very exciting first week. And I have to say that sometimes the week one of the tour can be a little boring. Not boring, but it is, you know, interesting for other reasons like crashes and all. This week was much, much more fun.
Yeah. While you, of course, while the crashes were less, but we still saw the key guys who mattered crash, and the key guys who we expected not to crash, not crashing. So while the overall the crashes were lesser, I think what would change GC really happened in terms of the crashes. So before I thought we can do it in a different way today. We will just, since we had actually, even though we call it week one, we have already had 9 stages and today is the second rest day. So I was thinking we'll do a quick recap of each of those stages, talk about each for a few minutes, and then probably summarize towards the end. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that will be an interesting way to kick it off. Let's do that.
Sure. So do you want to start off with the analysis of week one? And just before we do that, you know, we already had the tour cover all the 4 countries that it was supposed to cover. That is, we started off with Denmark, the first 3 stages, moved into France. We even had a slight detour into Belgium in one of the stages, and then had have been crisscrossing, you know, between Switzerland in the last couple of stages as well. So a lot to talk about. So let's start off with stage one, Sandeep.
Right. So stage one started in Copenhagen. This was a small short ITT of about 10 odd kilometers. And it turned out to be a very wet day. Most of the specialists and even the GC guys, they wanted to avoid the wet roads as per the weather forecast, and they had kind of planned to start much earlier in the day instead of, you know, the right at the fag end, which where we mostly see them. However, they could not really avoid the wet roads, and they actually, most of those specialists rode in the torrid rain on wet roads. The top favorite, Ghana, didn't really go as well as expected. He, in fact, was carrying a puncture towards the end, although he says that didn't really impact. Pogacar, the top gun, really, he was fantastic. He actually beat most of the specialists and was just a few seconds behind Wout van Aert, who looked like he was going to win the time trial and get the first yellow jersey. But interestingly, he was beaten pretty much very close to the end by Yves Lampaert, the Quickstep rider, who was a little lucky in the sense that by the time he started towards the end, it was a little less torrid in terms of rain. The roads were, although still wet, but the winds had kind of subsided a little. Although nothing to take, you know, not to take any credit from him, he was the fastest in the second half, which had all those loops and curves and bends. So well-deserved victory by Yves Lampaert to get the first yellow jersey for Quickstep.
Yeah,
that's how it was, the stage one went.
Yeah, I remember while listening to the commentator that Geraint Thomas went through his attempt when it was raining very hard, and I was just reminiscing our podcast the day before about how he's prone for crashes, and I was glad to see that he didn't crash that day. So
he did comment though, Gokul, that he was cornering like his wife. although being the liberal that he is, he immediately added that his wife hadn't ridden a bike for 12 years, just to lessen the blow.
Was he referring to his wife cornering on the bike or his wife cornering him during an argument?
I'm sure she must be doing that better than his cornering.
Anyways, so moving on to stage two. Stage two was in a way the first real stage or the first mass start stage, and as usual was a very nervous one because people there is full attendance and a lot of panic towards the sprint finishes, and people are always trying to avoid some crashes. And interestingly, it was a 200 kilometer or 202 kilometer stage, and towards the end they were riding over the sea in the world's third largest bridge, and it was a beautiful sight. It was an 18 kilometer long stretch. There were a lot of crosswinds expected, but it didn't really happen, and that was it turned out to be a headwind, and that proved to be helpful for a few, like Rigoberto Urán, who had a crash, and his team EF Education could pull him back and make him rejoin the peloton. And then it was a classic sprint finish with Michael Markov leading off and Fabio Jakobsen winning the sprint from Wout Van Aert. It was the second day for Wout in second position. And also it made it a top finish for the same team in both of the first 2 days of the tour. And I think there was only one previous occasion or never that the same team had won on all the first three stages. And it was expected to be very eventful or historic if Quickstep won the third stage as well. But that was how stage two went forward.
Yep, and it was a spectacular bridge, and it looked fantastic from the helicopter shots to just see such a huge long bridge over the sea connecting to that island.
Correct.
And that's one amazing factor of the tour, right? You get to see so many interesting places and of touristic interest, and probably, a lot of tourists in Europe at least would actually have probably now planned to make a trip to Copenhagen.
Correct, correct.
To see these wonders. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, even in the Giro, which started off in Hungary, it has been almost a wait for the last 2 years, I think, because 2020 was originally supposed to also be in starting from Hungary, but it didn't happen, and it finally happened this year. So there was a lot of expectation around it. It helps in bringing in a lot of tourists, and it also helps in another way, in the sense that it helps in building the sport in the local country as well. And a testament to that has been our EF Education's Magnus Scott, who was a Dane, and he pretty much was on the breakaway every stage of those 3 days in Denmark, and he took all the available points on the mountain stages, and he took the polka dot jersey, and just to see him, his celebration when he won the points, and it was clear that he's going to take the polka dot on that day too, was quite inspiring.
Yep, absolutely. And so stage two had, like you just mentioned, Fabio Jakobsen winning the sprint over Wout Van Aert. Wout Van Aert had another second place in stage three, where Dylan Groenewegen, another Dutch guy, actually took the win ahead of him. And Jakobsen was boxed in, so was Caleb Ewan. And it was also, in another way, a very symbolic win, because Dylan Groenewegen was involved in that extremely tragic crash with Fabio Jakobsen in Tour of Poland in 2020. Where Jakobsen was in coma for months, And he almost fought for his life. And then even after coming out of it, he took nearly a year to get back on the bike with all, you know, tons of surgeries on his jaw and his head and all. So they had history. And so it was pretty symbolic that the first sprint stage was won by Fabio Jakobsen and the next one by Dylan Groenewegen, you know, as in kind of circling, you know, both of them back into full form. Although Fabio wasn't very impressed with Dylan's win, and however, it was, you know, as expected.
Yeah, and going back to our discussions around team selection for Quickstep, and I think the win in stage two more than justified Fabio Jakobsen's a selection in the team ahead of Mark. So of course, it wasn't any surprise. He was the rider in top shape. So, but he still had to go and take that win, and he completed that, and thus denied Quickstep of also Groenewegen's win denied Quickstep of making it all three wins. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
The next day was actually a kind of a rest come transition day as the tour moved out of Denmark into the northern coast of France. And this was a 171.5 kilometer kind of race with 1700 meters of elevation gain. Well, again, was a very exciting day with Magnus Cort continuing his attacks on the continuing his breakaway with Anthony Perez of Cofidis, and both of them kind of shared the points in the sprint and the mountain classification, and finally again it was kind of a reminder of what happened in the Dauphiné, where Jumbo Visma as a team attacked, and then Wout Van Aert went ahead with 10 kilometers to go, and kind of easily won the stage. It was a real show of dominance by Team Jumbo Visma, and very funnily, Jakobsen thought that Jasper Philipsen won the sprint from the remaining group at the rear, and he didn't realize that Wout Van Aert had already won the stage and he was seen celebrating. So it was a much short-lived happiness though. And the next day was promising to be a very, very vital day as the tour moved on to the Parisian cobbles. And a lot was expected, and it was hoping, we are all hoping that there wouldn't be too many crashes. And what really happened on that day, Sandeep?
Yep, this was pretty much the most awaited stage of week one. You know, essentially using some of those cobble state parts, you know, which are actually used in Paris-Roubaix, the most iconic of all the classics. And this was supposed to be not just a, you know, a little fringe with the cobbles, but this was like a full-fledged cobble stage with I think 13 segments of it, and some of them were 4-star ones. So this was a brutal day, and you know, as we were discussing before the tour started, that probably this might be a day Jumbo Visma was going to test Pogacar and see how he goes on the cobbles, knowing his team wasn't as strong. Also, one of the premium classic riders that UAE was bringing, Matteo Trentin, was already out before even the tour started. So this was supposed to be a day to test Pogacar, but it turned out to be absolutely the other way around, because Roglic had a bad crash, say 20, 25 kilometers out. And he, in fact, dislocated his shoulder that he himself popped it back, sitting on a spectator chair. He again got back on the bike and started to chase, and he got some support from his team, not the entire team though. And he ended up losing 3 minutes to Pogacar. On the other hand, his teammate from Jumbo Visma, Vingegaard, who was the co-leader, he had a puncture or a mechanical, and he had a very, very bad bike change where he lost some time. But luckily for him, Wout Van Aert actually stopped over and, you know, and he came back for him to help with the chase. So there were, I think, three of Jumbo Visma riders, including Wout, helping Vingegaard chase back the front group. And meanwhile, on the front, Pogacar actually went out on the attack on one of the toughest cobbles section, along with a specialist, Jasper Stuyven. And both of them ended up, you know, in fact, at one point of time, they were a minute or more on top of, you know, ahead of the rest of the GC guys. Although the stage was won by from the breakaway by Simon Clark from Israel Startup Nation team, Pogacar came soon after and he could only win 15 seconds, I think. And that was mainly because of the solid work by Wout Van Aert and maybe Tom Pidcock from Ineos to chase that back. The chase was, the win from the breakaway was very interesting in the last 200 meters, where all four from the breakaway looked like at some point of time they were going to win the stage. So, you know, first guy attacked out of the group and the rest of them were, you know, waiting to chase, and then another guy tried to reach out. It was a very interesting way, and then Simon Clark was the last to hit out, patiently waiting for his chance, and the veteran actually won the stage. So that was a brutal day, very interesting to watch. It turned out to turn the race in a way, in the sense that what was supposed to be maybe Pogacar's weakness turned out to be another strength. 15 seconds won, not that many per se, but a show of strength from him, definitely.
Yeah. So it was very funny that day and very strange. Quite a few things were very strange that day, including the fact that Vingegaard did not have one, but I think 3-4 bike swaps. You know, first he tried to swap with one of his co-riders, then he swapped it with another co-rider, and then finally the team car pulled up with a spare bike. So it was a very funny day. I was wondering whether there was some lack of coordination from the team cars behind, or it was just the positioning or the place where they had punctured that caused this. And do you think that the crash of Roglic could have been avoided?
I saw that live, and so this was I think the crash was basically caused by a loose bale of hay coming onto the path of the riders. And the first guy to fall off, I think, was Caleb Ewan, whose bad luck seems to keep going. He looked pretty good. He was in the front group along with these GC guys, and he ended up crashing. And then it appeared, although it was not very visible as far as I remember, seeing Roglic crash there, but it looked like he had crashed behind him. So, I don't know. I think he had just bad luck, pure bad luck, falling behind this small group of favorites.
Yeah.
That's how it is.
Yeah. And I don't know, if you have to probably check that day with some astrologers, because everybody in Team Jumbo-Visma had a bad day that day. The great Wout Van Aert also crashed. And he... narrowly missed a very bad accident while trying to get back after his personal crash, where he just missed the rear view mirrors of one of the team cars by his cross country skills, because otherwise he could have cyclocross skills, because he was almost on the verge of hitting the rear view mirror, and it could have been a very bad crash, reminding us of the crash I think last year in the Tour of Flanders of Julian Alaphilippe, where he crashed against a
motorbike.
So, yeah, it could have been very bad, and it was such a great maneuver to avoid something really bad from out. And the best followed the worst day for Jumbo-Visma between stage 4 and stage 5. So, and stage 6 continued to be weird for Jumbo-Visma. It was It was a historic day in the Tour de France annals, as it was one of the fastest day for a stage which was this long. It was the longest stage of this year at 220 kilometers with 2,500 meters of climbing, and I think they tried to form so many breakaways, but it was not, no big breakaway was able to go away. And then finally, a small breakaway of three with Fuglsang, Quinn Simmons and Wout Van Aert went away. And I think they were trying to, they were not very happy with Fuglsang not doing work. And then he just suddenly pulled out. And the Quinns tried his best to stay with Wout, but it was riding for a lost cause, because the peloton was riding very fast and there was no way with 60-80 kilometers to go, three or two people are going to be able to stay ahead. But still they pushed ahead, and Quinns did share a lot of workload, but with 30 kilometers to go and with the peloton very close behind, Wout went ahead. And I think with about 10 kilometers to go, he was caught back. And he was so spent that he couldn't even stick with the peloton and got lost 7 minutes on the peloton eventually. There were a couple of climbs in the last 10 kilometers. And it was just one of those days where nothing really went as per plan.
I felt, Gokul, that this was a very weird move by Wout van Aert. Mm. I mean, the previous day was the cobble stage where I thought he would be up front. He wasn't. Mm. And this on stage six, this was a perfect finish for Wout van Aert per se, right? This was like a medium, short, very short ramp to the finish. Of only 5-6%, something that he really does well, to sprint up that kind of thing after a light bunch of hills. Just the perfect, he's the perfect rider for the finish.
Yeah.
But instead of that, he was out there on a break, which was completely futile with just two other guys out there.
Correct.
And I don't understand why he persisted with that. What was the intention? It was very weird that the way it went.
Yeah.
Looked like, I mean, the last, those three stages, 4, 5, and 6, I couldn't figure out what Jumbo-Visma were trying to do.
Mm.
Where, you know, four Wout van Aert, you know, attacked 10 kilometers away from the finish to go solo. And the next one, he could have, you know, probably won the stage. Although, yeah, he was a great help to his teammates. But, you know, they might have given him the day off that day, you know, from the duties. But instead, he was on team duty. And on this day, he was out on the break when it was tailor-made for him. So it was like complete lack of sense, in my opinion, the way it went for Jumbo.
Mm. Yeah. And finally, Pogacar won. In fact, it was a little funny to see Roglic attack a little too early towards the last half a kilometer or so. But Pogacar just was way too strong for Roglic's attack to really have any effect on him, and he easily overtook him and won it comfortably.
And that got Pogacar in the yellow.
Correct.
You know.
Yeah, and that's again a very different thing from traditional practices, where the key GC contenders try to avoid getting the yellow very early on, because carrying the yellow jersey, in addition to having all the attention, is also taking a lot of time from the riders on a day-to-day basis, because the people in yellow jersey, the person in yellow jersey has to attend a lot of media conferences and the dope tests and stuff like that, which significantly delays their recovery and return to the hotel. So generally, GC contenders try to avoid getting it in the week one, you know, try to keep it towards the second half of week two, so that the they get more time for themselves in the early part of the tour. But Pogacar is in a different league all on. He, who I wouldn't be surprised if, in fact, he had the chance of taking yellow even on day one to, this year.
Very narrowly.
So what about stage seven, Sandeep?
Stage seven was going to be the place where we were actually supposed to see Pogacar show himself for the first time. That's what we thought. It was like the first big mountaintop finish. This was like a relatively short stage ending in a I think it was an 8 or 10 kilometer long hill called Planche du Belfier. Mm-hmm. And ends in a very, very steep way. I think the last couple of kilometers were even, you know, going up to 14 and 15. In fact, there was a small bit of gravel in the last kilometer. So this was a tough finish and a super steep hill. And for the longest time, it looked like that the breakaway was going to finally win something here. Leonard Kamna was right in front and he looked good to, you know, he was climbing well. He had a gap from the attacking peloton.
Mm-hmm.
But then the group of favorites started to ride fast. In fact, Team UAE, they were, you know, drilling in a very, very fast pace.
Mm-hmm.
First, I think Brandon McNulty and then Rafael Maika. And then, you know, when Rafael Maika couldn't go any further, he waved his hand forward, you know, as if to say, okay, after you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where Pogacar just, you know, went.
Yeah.
But then it looked like, you know, Vingegaard, he made a huge attack. And for a while, it looked like Pogacar wasn't, you know, responding to him straight away. It looked like there was a decent gap opened up. And Vingegaard, he first caught Kamna. And then it looked like he was going to solo to win right to the line. But then before we could realize anything, Pogacar again made another huge acceleration and caught up with Vingegaard, and before you know, we could realize that he had in fact accelerated once again to take the win. So this was like back-to-back wins by Pogacar again. And he basically just showed that, you know, no matter what terrain you give me. So in week one, he, you know, stamped his authority first in the time trial, then, you know, on the cobbles, then on a short finish ramp. And then here on the first big mountaintop finish.
Yeah.
Yet again, Pogacar just blew the opposition away.
So, yeah, in fact, I heard the commentator saying many times that he didn't really need a team. You know, he has been so strong, though he had a much stronger team this year. And the face of Rafael Maika before he waved his hands, indicating Pogacar to take over, was telling a thousand different stories of all dipped in deep pain. So they did really pull themselves, but many times it felt as if Pogacar was so assured and so calm that he really didn't need any team members, but he did have some good support that day. And again, the next day, I was also the team came to the front, and UAE controlled the race for much of the day. But things went back to normalcy for Jumbo-Visma, and Wout van Aert again showed his explosiveness to take the win. And of course, Pogacar was still not far behind, and he came third, and continues to show that there is no stage in which he is far behind.
Yeah, I mean, I found it quite weird. I mean, how Pogacar wanted to show himself on every stage pretty much in this first week. I mean, did he think this was like a 9-stage Tour de France? I mean, was that what he thought? Because he couldn't just have enough of it sitting back in his team and just letting others do the work. And maybe let somebody else take the win, since he was already ahead of his GC guys by this time for, you know, by about 30, 35 seconds. But no, he had to take the sprint and, you know, get those 4 extra bonus seconds.
I think you were clairvoyant, Sandeep, because I remember you telling me in the preview of this year that the biggest strength that Pogacar has is his strength of recovery from stage to stage. And probably he is just telling you that what he said is true. He has that confidence to recover and shine till the end of the tour.
Yep, I think that's something to be seen though. I mean, tour is still 2 weeks to go. So, yeah, there is much to play for.
In fact, as we move on from the individual stages to a few things that I noted, the first thing, very interestingly, that I wanted to talk about was recovery and where recovery failed for another rider. It is strange. I would have never thought in the preview that we would cover the first 9 stages without even mentioning the name of Mathieu van der Poel. So that was how badly he was. He has not recovered from his attacks in the Giro, I think. And especially there was a telling moment, and it was so shocking. The two guys whom we thought will shine on stage 5 on cobbles, the present day classic specialists in Mathieu van der Poel and Wout van Aert, both had an exceedingly off day. Of course, Wout has generally been good. I think he was a little shaken by the crash that he had, and he was probably not feeling too good after the crash, that he was just he left any hopes of attacking for that day. But even Mathieu van der Poel, there was a point where he was riding on the sidelines of one of the sections of gravel cobblestones where on the grass, and he was just shaking his head, and he had absolutely no power left in him. And it was so shocking to see that somebody with such brute power can be brought down to their knees so quickly. It was quite shocking, and such a disappointment of this tour, I should say. I'm, in fact, I am wondering why, if he is so tired, he's still continuing. I don't understand whether he really has any hopes of recovering and doing anything else later on in the tour. Why is he continuing in the tour if he's in such bad shape? I couldn't understand. You had any thoughts on that, Sandeep?
Yes, Gokul. And in a way, so we saw Mathieu van der Poel doing what Wout van Aert is doing at the tour is at the Giro. He looks superhuman on days, and attacking from afar, contesting bunch sprints, and being good everywhere. But then I in a way it shows that even guys like Mathieu van der Poel and even Wout van Aert are probably human. When they overburn themselves in a couple of weeks of the Giro, they actually end up overcooked, like you would expect others to be. So in a way, it actually shows that they're human, and they have to plan better. And just being super brute strength is not going to, always help you win. And you need to be tactically smart as well, something that we have seen both of them, not pay heed to so much so far.
Yeah, I mean, that is true. In fact, You stole the point of my next observation of the week one, which was like, all riders are human unless your last name is Pogacar. In the sense that many times we take so many things for granted, right? The Wout van Aert or a Pogacar or a Mathieu van der Poel attacking in those steep short sections and showing their brute power which they can produce, and being so versatile, being such great bike handlers and all. But still, the great Wout van Aert, after coming second in the first 3 stages, winning the 4th stage and showing such utter dominance with his team, had a crash in stage 5, for somebody of his bike handling skills, it was something there was nothing he could do about that crash, you know. There was a slight slowing around a corner, and some road furniture was also there, and you know, just the continued braking, and it was just the only thing that he could have done is by not being in that position, he was too far behind, and that that avalanche effect of those braking result gave him no time, and he had a crash. And I think it took him a bit to get out of the crash. In fact, his near avoidance of the other crash that we talked about earlier probably woke him up, and he seemed to be slightly better off after that point. And similarly, there were a couple of other very funny things, like just like how we couldn't understand the tactics of Wout on stage six the day before. Alberto Bettiol from team EF Education had a very strange attack wherein he was feeling strong, and he has also been through a lot of sickness and has been off color for a while. And he was in the front with Pogacar, and the cameras caught them having a quick chat, and then both of them zipping off. And in fact, even their team boss, Jonathan Waters, quoted saying that this will be an interesting post-race debrief. So nobody could understand it. And later on, in fact, some people were even speculating that Bettiol was joining UAE, because when he attacked with Pogacar, there were two of his teammates in the breakaway up ahead. So it would have been really a very bad scene if he had managed to bridge that gap with Pogacar. However, he punctured later and he couldn't continue that. But later on, some people were saying, we really do not know what happened. Bettiol clarified, saying that it was Pogacar who asked him whether he can go on an attack, and he said he doesn't have much left and he wouldn't be given the freedom to attack, but he can stay behind Pogacar, is what he told Pogacar apparently. But some others were even speculating that Bettiol was rediscovering his legs, and he was so excited that he wanted to see how good he is, because he has waited for so long, for the almost the entire year or season, for discovering his legs. So all these events showed the humanness, and there was one guy who was still showing he was superhuman, attacking in climbs, attacking in ITT, and showing off in all the sprints. You know, the sprints in the stages that on the climbs towards the end, that once Vingegaard and the other time Roglic threw at him, he covered them with such ease on stage six and nine, I think it was, that it almost looked ridiculously simple, and you know, as if he was in a very, very different league. The other point that I wanted, the last point that I observed was, I still think bike handling plays such a huge role. Though, like you told earlier, I also felt that it was very difficult for Roglic to have avoided that crash. The only thing that he could have done is probably not been there in that position, and you know, we don't control that often. For example, last year when he crashed on the first week, he was very close to the front. So you never know. But and that time he was towards the right-hand side of the peloton, and this time he was on the left-hand side, but he still had a near unavoidable crash. And but Pogacar was so calm and collected throughout all the difficult stages, and he was always in the right place. And that was a very key difference between the two greats from the same country. Whereas Pogacar has got a history of MTB and cyclocross racing, that has given him that additional bike handling, better bike handling skills like MVDP and Wout and Pidcock and so on. Whereas Roglic, given his background as a world junior ski champion, he probably doesn't have the same amount of time and the race experience and the calmness that comes with being having that better bike control. That bad luck just seems to follow him. So it's a, I don't know whether it is just something we are telling or it was just plain simple bad luck this time, but bike handling does play a huge role. At least it may not have been able to avoid the crashes that the team Jumbo-Visma had, but I am pretty sure it has helped Pogacar from avoiding crashes this year.
So you're quite right, Gokul, that the bike handling can play such a huge role in winning tours and longevity and the amount of palmares you have. And you look at a guy like Peter Sagan, for example. There are very few occasions in his long career you would see him having crashed. I mean, there have been so many instances where you would see a huge crash happening right in front of him and he would somehow bunny hop over somebody or just somehow manage to squeeze through whatever gap is left to, not crash. So there are some guys like that in the peloton whose bike handling skill are legendary and, who have such a great record of avoiding crashes. Yeah. And that can play such a huge role. You might be having the form of your life, but if you crash out in week one,
correct,
then you have nothing to show for it. Maybe Roglic might have been in the best form of his life. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But with the crash, with his dislocated shoulder, the pain, not being able to sleep properly that night, recovering, not being able to recover that well day on, day out, I'm sure his chance of winning the tours are pretty much next to over now because of just one bad incident of that crash. So that can play such a huge role on it.
True. And even the great Peter Sagan crashed in the last week. So
his greatness is probably eluding him now.
Yeah. But it's one thing is all these great bike handlers have not, it's not as if they have not crashed, right? In fact, they have had legendary crashes. In fact, if I have to go back in history, Wout had a very career-threatening crash, I think in 2018 or 19, and he lost almost the second half of the season. And to aggravate things, I think his surgeon messed up attaching one of his ligaments and there was some screw up there. And he had a very, very long road to recovery before he came back and dominated in Milan-San Remo, if I'm not wrong, in 2019. So they have all had their fair bit of crashes. Similarly, last year in the cross country MTB World Olympic Championships, MVDP made a newbie mistake, right? So what happens is many times during their practice runs, they keep the ramps and later for the final run they remove it, and he didn't notice one of those ramps being removed in the final run and had a massive crash. And he was preparing so much for that particular to get the Olympic gold, and it was such a big disappointment. In fact, he cut short his tour last year to be in better shape to go and ride the MTB in the Olympics. So, I mean, even the greatest have had their crashes. So I think you learn from crashing.
You have some experience, I know.
Can't avoid that, dude, can we? So, what were your key takeaways from this week, Sandeep?
So Gokul, you've mentioned a couple of times that all of these guys are human except Pogacar. But I'm not sure about it yet. He was just, as we saw, overactive in week one. He was gunning on the IDT, which is obviously understandable. He was right up there on the cobbles, even trying to attack, although he didn't win much time there. And then even on the short sprint on stage six, and then obviously he was always going to play a big role on the first mountaintop finish. So on so many of these stages in week one, he was so active. He was putting his team right up front to, drive the hard pace all the way. And he himself dug in so deep for so many of these stages. I think it reminds me, in fact, of Adam Yates in 2018 Giro. Adam Yates, if you remember in the Giro d'Italia, he in 2018 he was extremely strong in the first 2 weeks. He looked invincible, in fact. He I think won three stages, and he was like just attacking from far, dropping everybody, and there looked no chance of anybody coming close to him. But then on the penultimate stage or the penultimate mountain stage in week three of the Giro, he was completely thrashed by them. He bonked, and in fact he lost like 10 minutes or something in just one stage, just finishing his Giro right there. I doubt Pogacar would fade that badly. He has already so much experience with the tour itself, and he probably is smarter than that. But I still feel he has been needlessly attacking at times and not trying to conserve. He doesn't, he's definitely not from the generation of riders who would play conservative, keep their energy reserves for the week three, where the real mountains come and minutes can be won or lost. So for all of his efforts in week one, Pogacar has only 39 seconds of time on Jonas Vingegaard. So which is 39 seconds is not meaningless, not trivial. Tours have been won even on 5 seconds and 10 seconds, but 39 seconds is also not a huge buffer on somebody. Jonas looks like to be a exceptional climber himself, and I think Jonas has not been trying to do all these needless attacks so far. He's only followed, and apart from Wout van Aert, his team has not been trying to show themselves all the time. So we don't really know how Pogacar is going to fare in the third week. And all of this efforts could come back to bite him, just like what we see with MVDP now. So we don't know for sure how Pogacar is going to be in week three. And this time, Jonas Vingegaard could actually do a Pogacar, like Pogacar did to Roglic 2 years back. He is right there at that level. He is good on the ITT, and he's exceptional on the climbs. In fact, last year he was the only guy who could actually drop Pogacar, right, on one of these mountains. So I think the tour is far from over. Pogacar is, I think he might show himself to be human after all in week three. So this is something I feel we need to see how he goes, and whether is he going to regret all of what has been doing in week one or not.
I kind of agree with this, but my concern or fear is, has there been already enough damage done to Team Jumbo-Visma that they'll be able to capitalize on it? Team Ineos is reasonably unscathed and is capable of pulling it off. Do you think there are enough people available with enough energy reserves left to exploit in case of a last week fade by Pogacar?
I think number one, I think Jumbo Visma, in a way, now Roglic being not as a front, co-leader anymore, as far as we know, the hierarchy is now naturally set now in Jumbo Visma team. And I think they have not really used up their team so much. We haven't seen Sepkus anywhere so far. We haven't seen really Steven Kruijswijk right in the front leading the peloton. And Vaupenaar has been visible for sure, but you know the other members of their team have been preserved so far for the week two and three. And now Roglic, I'm sure in a after this rest day and maybe you know by the time the week three comes, which is another week to go, maybe he would recover a little bit himself to help to be able to in a position to play his card or help Jonas Vingegaard to really chase Pogacar or attack him. So I think they are well positioned still, Jumbo Visma. And UAE has also lost one rider by now. They lost one of their riders to, I think, COVID. So they are not in the best. Yeah, they're not the best position already.
Okay.
Also notice, Gokul, we haven't seen Team Ineos at all in week one.
Correct, correct.
Apart from, all the jokes about Geraint Thomas riding with his gilet on, forgetting to take it off, and maybe Tom Pidcock, in white jersey. We haven't seen them at all. They have been completely invisible in week one, which is very exceptional, right? That's another interesting thing. For the last so many years, we've all been used to seeing Team Ineos, doing, what Team Jumbo-Visma or, Team UAE are doing right now, being right up in front and center for the tour, starting from stage one. Right now, for this, for the first nine stages, they have largely been invisible. So I think they are betting on their week three. They are about a minute and a half behind, a minute 20 or a minute and a half behind Pogacar at this point with their two leaders, Geraint and Adam Yates. And I think they are waiting for week three to see how it goes and how these two play it out. And maybe they will get a chance to sneak in when things are messy between these two.
You well said. That is definitely possible. So, any other observations from this week, or shall we move on to?
So, this first week has not been exceptionally nice for the breakaways. Actually, two breakaways have won a stage so far in Bob Jungels, in stage nine, and then the hobble stage where Simon Clark won. But we haven't seen that many strong breakaways trying to get a win. We haven't seen those huge ones, that are usual. But I think still week one, which is the time gaps are not so huge. And so, a lot of the riders are not allowed to go in the breakaway by the peloton. So they have been largely unsuccessful. And the GC guys have been, in play all the time. But I think in week two, we will start seeing the breaks starting to happen. I'm sure a lot of these punchers have earmarked, week two and week three for their, key stages where they're going to attack. So I think we will see a lot more action from the break now.
Cool. Yeah, that is true. And in fact, it has not been that, like you rightly said, it has been the more of the fact that it has been more difficult to get into a breakaway, a bigger group. Stage six, for example, I think they were struggling so hard to form a breakaway. So the peloton has been very fast as well on days.
Yeah, that's the nature of it, I guess. Yeah, and it's getting faster and faster every year. And cool. That's true.
Okay, so anything else you want to cover about week one, Sandeep?
No, Gokul, the points classification that we were discussing earlier looks to be heading, nowhere. We thought that we were going to see some exciting battle between Wout and his eternal rival, Matthew. However, Matthew, as we discussed, has been not at his competitive best. He looks fatigued, while Wout and Van Aert has been like, kind of coming in the first, first 10, first five, even first second for so many stages that he looks to have be having a huge lead right now on the points classification. And there's been no standout sprinter so far, right? There's just been one stage each won by Fabio and Dylan Groenewegen and then Wout himself. So The sprint stage, there's not been a dominant sprinter to mop up all those sprint points. So I think Wout looks to be the best bet to steal this points classification.
Okay.
Yep.
I had a question for you. Given that the nature of the team, the present team composition of Team Jumbo Visma, do you think both Wout and the team will benefit if he was not part of this team? Because Wout really is so strong that he deserves a team which works for him rather than the other way around, like what MVDP has with his team. With having such good GC contenders like Vingegaard and Roglic, Team Jumbo-Visma's tactics also or some days could be compromised for satisfying Wout. Do you think that is affecting their overall results? Do you think they would be better off if they split?
I think it's a very, very interesting question, and I think that's the question of the tour so far, of how, you know, does he net to net, does Wout contribute to the team's GC prospect, or does he take it away? That's the question, right? And I think there's no definite answer so far. We will probably have an answer by the end of the tour. But I think there are two aspects that I feel here. Number one, Wout is equal to two domestics in terms of his strength. I mean, the kind of power that he has, I mean, be it flats, be it cobbles, be it even the mountains, even the high mountains. I mean, the guy is equivalent to two domestics. So that definitely counts for something if used well. And number two, assuming Pogacar is after all not human and he wins the, you know, the yellow very easily, Wout can actually salvage their tour, right? Who remembers coming in third on the tour? But I mean, a guy like Wout winning, let's say, three, four stages in the tour would be far more successful for the team and their sponsors, like we were discussing on, you know, on the preview one. Amount of eyeballs, the amount of media coverage that Wout gets, the amount of fan following that the team gets courtesy him increases manifold because of that, and he's always visible. So that aspect is always obviously of great help to the team. So I think he's a great asset to the team, and if they utilize him well and ensure that his personal ambitions don't completely go, you know, against the team's GC goals, I think he would still be of great help to Jonas and maybe even Roglic.
Good, only time will tell. We'll see. So before we wrap up, do you want to give you a preview of week two, what we can expect in the next week?
Yep, I mean I just casually looked through the stage profiles. So we have already done through 9 stages, and 10th is a medium mountain stage, apparently ending on a airport strip or something. We'll exactly have to see how it is, but yep. Then we have 3 high mountain stages, one after the other. On 11, we have the Galibier and Col de Granon, both above 2,000 meters, high altitude. So 2,600 even going for Col de Galibier, which is the highest point that the tour will go through. So high mountains on 11. And then on the 12th, we have Alpe d'Huez, another epic and legendary Tour de France climb. Alpe d'Huez and then Croix de Fer. Again, very, very close to 2,000 meters or both. Okay. And they are climbing the Alpe d'Huez on the Bastille Day, which is the French National Day. And I'm sure some of the French riders would definitely have penciled in the stage for themselves. So after 3 mountain days for the GC guys, there is likely going to be a sprinter stage on 13. So it's a bump run, and maybe the breakaway can, fool the sprinters in the sprinter teams. And then 14, 15 are again mid-mountain stages for the breakaways. Looks like, I mean, the profile seems to indicate, you know, that the breakaways would probably get them. They're not so high and they don't end on a mountain top. So, you know, we might expect a breakaway on both 14th and 15th stage.
Cool.
So a lot of mountains, you know, couple of two or three mid-mountain stages, three high mountain stages, and then a sprinter stage. So a lot of climbing in week two, and for sure we will see, you know, whether Jonas Vingegaard is climbing even better than Pogacar or not.
Cool. So so much for predictions, right? Like you were saying, how the green jersey points has become a pretty lame affair, and while the first week has been exceedingly dominated by Pogacar, it does open up a small hope that things can get interesting in week two and three in the GC race. So hopefully things will get interesting there, and we will catch up again next week for the updates from week two and the preview for the last week of the tour.
Yes. Let's hope we have a closer race when we talk again.
Yeah.
At the end of week two, and, you know, something more exciting to look for.
Yeah. I mean, even if it is irrespective, many times I still felt that I learned a lot more in this 1 week than many other tours, even though it was at times very boring to see the way Pogacar was dominating. But it did bring in so many other aspects, especially the strange tactics of Team Jumbo-Visma, Wout van Aert, Alberto Bettiol, and all those really opened up a lot of questions and made me think a lot. So I think it's okay to have some boring stages as well, but hopefully we are done with them. Okay.
Cool.
Okay. Thank you, Sandeep. Thank you, listeners. So we'll catch you again in a week for the stage two updates. Bye.
Bye-bye.